little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, Julia, were you and I both excited about having this guest that we're all connected up to and ready to go?
Today's topics include implementing and using AI-assisted tools in education, the benefits and risks these tools pose for students and faculty, currently available AI resources that can be used to support lifelong learning and critical thinking by helping users build foundational knowledge and gather evidence to support claims, conclusions, and beliefs, and a discussion of our future living with AI. I, for one, welcome our AI overlords.
Oh, that's a good line. I love that line. Holding a bachelor's degree in mathematics and a master's degree in environmental systems with a focus in mathematical modeling, our guest, Professor Kyle Falbo, previously taught mathematics at Humboldt State University and at College of the Redwoods and Salt Lake Community College. And currently, he's a lecturer in both the mathematics and computer science departments at Sonoma State University, and an educational technology application expert in the Center for Teaching and Educational Technology at Sonoma State University, where he helps faculty and staff integrate technology, including new artificial intelligence tools, into their teaching and other tasks. Kyle Falbo, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here, Kyle. Can you fill us in on some of the details that might help our listeners understand how your interests in mathematics, environmental issues, and computer modeling brought you to the specialty of using technology, including AI, of course, in educational settings?
You know, I think a lot of folks that are deeply connected to technology have like unconventional paths to get there, and mine is very similar to that in the sense that my connection to technology goes all the way back to my childhood. My dad and his high school friends started a laser light show company that was called Laser Dreams, where they were experimenting with some of the first laser hardware and software for the Commodore 64 called the Bitemare. I remember I was learning to digitize images on this old Koala pad. And while it was both fascinating, it was also frustrating. The tools were so limited at the time. And what really struck me then, early on, was how math and art kind of came together in this medium. So you had to optimize the graphics in this very constrained computing environment. So things like equations really gave you a lot more power than being able to just individually digitize points. This experience showed me very early on how technology, mathematics, creativity could all be so kind of deeply interconnected. And then as I grew into more mathematics, that connection to technology kept pulling me back into larger systems. So mathematical structures, remote sensing, environmental modeling, and understanding the connection to these ecosystems. And it wasn't even the path that I expected, right? When I first started college, I really wanted to see computers start generating music based on the collection of all of human music, something very similar to what Suno does today, but without the, you know, commercialization and the bad vocals. And what I kept finding myself as I was going through my educational career and getting exposed to more these kind of interconnected systems and how technology interplays with these interconnected systems, there was this simple representation that you could look at on complex systems. And if you could do that, and that's really the basics behind modeling here, is that if you can have a simple representation of a complex system, then you can start asking more questions and better questions as you learn more about the system through that modeling process. And what I ended up finding, especially when I got into my own research, was that I just kept on butting heads with what the edge of technology that I had access to could do at the time. And so I was just really fascinated being able to like stretch those boundaries just to see what was possible. So that kind of leads into when I entered into a higher ed career. that theme was just continuing. So I watched faculty at the time that were building their own online homework systems that were on servers that they were maintaining themselves. And I saw institutions that were experimenting with things like beaming microwave frequencies to beam classes to Fort Bragg and Del Norte and out to Hoopa. And then, of course, during the pandemic, we saw this huge shift, right? Faculty who had never put homework online suddenly have to run video lectures, manage Zoom breakout rooms, and rethink how to connect with students. And so really, that was kind of this like pivotal moment for me where I started to see how universal design for learning, this notion that technology can expand opportunity when it's applied thoughtfully. And now with AI entering the picture, it feels like just another one of these game-changing moments. So I don't think we fully grasped yet what AI is going to do in terms of reshaping the education in our lives or in our children's lives for that matter. But I think for now, I think it's just about staying grounded in questions and curiosity and how we might use these tools responsibly and how we can use them for equity, social justice, creativity, and better understanding rather than a workplace efficiency or novelty.
And I love how that all has an origin in laser light shows.
Yeah. And to this day, I still love doing some laser light shows and watching some beams going out above a crowd and really thinking about the mathematics that's going on behind all that and really pushing the limits of what the venue has to offer, what the airspace allows you to offer, any of those kinds of things. So it really is about pushing boundaries and playing with what you've got.
I looked into the origins of computer-assisted instruction, and it can actually be traced back to Plato. Now, that's not the philosopher Plato. It's a program at the University of Illinois back in the 1960s called the Plato Project, and that stands for Program Logic for Automated Teaching Operations. I remember when I was teaching at the community college level, we use teacher aids like automated grading programs and things like that. So that's been around for many years. But it really seems to me like the successes of generative AI and large language models have taken that to a whole new level. So, Kyle, I've got three questions for you. The first one is, what capabilities does AI add to the previous instructional non-AI assisted tools? And secondly, which specific AI-powered educational tools are you implementing there at Sonoma State? And what are the challenges of making that happen?
What AI is adding is personalization and adaptability. And so, for example, last year in one of my math classes, I experimented with using a student interest survey to drive AI-generated assignments. So from that interest survey, one student might end up comparing the sales trends of different subgenres of manga, another analyzing streaming data between K-pop and hip-hop, and another one looking at like the safety statistics for different movie stunts. And so the math concepts were the same. It was just that the framing was very personal to their interest. And that's just one of just an infinite number of ways that AI can just open up the landscape for personalization. At Sonoma State, what we're working with is a range of tools. There's our system-wide partnership. So the CSU is in partnership with OpenAI, which is providing an enterprise-level access to ChatGPT. But all of that data is being protected, and the security standards that are kind of required by working with the California State University system. And the total emphasis behind that decision was around equity. It was about making sure that students were getting access to the same powerful tools that somebody who can afford for the paid version of ChatGPT is getting, and not having inequity between those students and the students that are using the free version of ChatGPT. We're also exploring Google's Notebook LM as part of our Google Workspace environment. Through our learning management system, there's access to KhanMigo, which is from Khan Academy. And then we have even more practical integrations like using Zoom's AI-generated meeting summaries to help faculty develop content such as like lecture notes. the work is really both exploratory at this place, but also pretty applied, just kind of testing what's out there, making sure that we focus on tools that are genuinely enhanced learning and teaching. I'll just mention a couple other tools that I see faculty working with that we don't have licenses for, so we don't actually support them as much. But Gamma is a really wonderful like slide deck creation tool that makes some pretty slick presentations with just like 30 seconds of prompting and uploading of an outline. And then we see some other folks even experimenting with things like Suno to generate little quick songs that are based on the content of the course and sharing those things. And, you know, it's kind of gimmicky and novelty, but students are embracing it. Now, the challenge, first, really, it is equity. We don't want a situation where students or faculty with access to paid tools are getting advantages over those with free ones. So that's really a big reason why we pursued the partnership with OpenAI to really kind of level the playing field while also ensuring security. The second related to that is trust. People need to know that their data and their conversations are safe, not being used to train the models. And they also need a clear sense of when to trust the AI output and just when human oversight is really essential on those outputs. And the third is a tough one, which is change management. And this is really the hardest part because it's not the technology, it's the people. Some faculty are energized, some are cautious, and both of these reactions are valid. I think a lot of what a newer English faculty member shared with me was that they were suddenly faced with just wave of AI-generated essays and really trying to struggle through what that means for their job in the future. And it's just what they said was that this isn't what they signed up for and it isn't fun. And that's real. And so my job, especially more recently, has been this balancing act of how do we help faculty innovate with these exciting new tools while also protecting the integrity of their classroom and respecting what their expectations are of authentic student engagement.
I can relate to that a little bit because I was teaching during the time that computers became prevalent in education and web pages and that sort of thing. I know that there's a lot of resistance, especially the older faculty, at least there was at that time, to using the technology. Of course, students are very comfortable using computer software and applications and things, but people are somewhat hesitant about AI. So I imagine there's some resistance from maybe even especially the older faculty who think they can do it better, that AI is not going to give them any real help or assistance in doing this. Do you find that?
I hate to characterize it by age because I'm not seeing that as being the distinguishing factor. Mm-hmm. And I also don't want to distinguish this based on like technophobe in a sense, right? It's that there are faculty that are genuinely concerned about the real risks involved with students' use of AI. And there are also, what I would consider is that this is just another thing being thrown at instructors in a really, really challenging time for instructors that they have to pick up, right? So we just got done forcing faculty without any support whatsoever to move all their classes into a remote modality and teach for a year, year and a half online. And that was such a big challenge for so many faculty. And they, for the most part, did great. We got through and we've got students that are still educated as a result of that. Now, we could study what ended up being lacking from that. But what I also saw was huge gains for students that were being able to operate in an environment that was radically different than it was in the in-person classroom, social experiment environment that is the college campus. And so you look at instructors who just came off the wave of that, and now you're being told, hey, there's this tool and this technology that's going to be what our future is. And yes, it's coming behind a lot of money, and you got to get on board with learning and teaching it effectively when none of us have any education in AI. Most of us don't even know how it works. And so now you're asking these faculty members to just adopt this technology and become experts of that technology and apply it to their field of expertise and then bring that into the classroom to effectively teach students how to use it. And that's not a fair ask.
It's great that you have some empathy with those issues, because that really helps rather than just say, you got to do this. It sounds like when you work with faculty that you're understanding the basic issues that they're dealing with emotionally, psychologically, to accommodate this change, because it is a big change. One other thing that I thought about as you were talking, you mentioned two things that come with AI-enhanced technology, and one was personalization, and was the other adaptability?
Accessibility. I think I did say adaptability. Yeah. Accessibility, I think, is a better proxy for that.
Okay, accessibility. It made me think about one of the programs we had at the community colleges that I worked at was very well-developed tutoring programs. And as I am beginning to use AI, and I use Copilot, for example, I'm a Windows user, and so that's on Windows. And I find that it knows my name, it knows the things that I've been asking it, and it uses those as references when it's answering my questions, and it's adapting to my needs. You know, it just shows me that AI would be very strong in terms of AI tutoring programs. And do you have any of those at Sonoma State, and what's your feeling about AI tutoring?
Well, Sonoma State doesn't have any AI tutoring per se. We are working with our tutoring center to start kind of thinking through and having best practices in place about how our student tutors are interacting with other students in the conversation of AI. Mm-hmm. And so giving those tutors some kind of understanding of the landscape of the access of AI. So one of the things that we're really, really pushing for faculty is to having their like very clear syllabus statements. And it doesn't just end with a syllabus statement. So having a syllabus statement, having active conversations with students about what is and isn't appropriate about AI in their classes, and then even at taking it so far as to having rubric statements or assignment level statements about AI use on those assignments. And I think with the absence of those, it's really going to be challenging for a tutor to interact with a student who's sitting there working on that assignment with AI right there on the side, plugging things in along the way and getting answers and asking the tutor to interact in that experience, right? Because if that instructor is just like not at all, then now that puts that student tutor in a conflict, and they might not know what the policies of those individual instructors are. So I think we're really kind of walking a thin line about being able to both empower our student tutors to be able to work in this AI space, but also respecting the needs of the faculty members and their classroom environments along the way. One of the things that I've been working with specifically in this AI tutoring space is there's some wonderful, wonderful tutor prompts that are out there. And even the ChatGPT has a study mode that is essentially just a tutor prompt built in with some additional statements like, don't ever, ever, ever give the answer, always ask follow-up questions. That's like the basics of that tutor prompt.
Can you clarify what you mean by tutor prompt for folks who may not understand that?
Oh, sure, sure. So, you know, there's a lot of best practices regarding tutoring, right? You don't just give students the answers. You ask follow-up questions. You ask them what they already know about the material. You ask them at what level of understanding they know that material. You ask if they have particular questions about that material. And then you continue to lead with additional questions. Like if they get one step of the way, you can ask them, okay, well, what do you think happens next?
These are notions that we already had about what it is to be a good and effective tutor.
That's right. And so if you can just sit there and spell out in natural language what it means to be a good tutor, you can tell an AI do those things, and it does a great job. We had a pilot for a tool called Roomy, which is basically an AI on the side writing platform. And what's nice about that platform is it allowed instructors to see the interactions that the students were having with the AI in the completion of their assignments. And it would kind of track the students' writing process, which is really, really fascinating to see. And you could give that AI prompt that tutor prompt. And suddenly now the interaction that the students were having, they weren't just asking for answers. They weren't just asking for paragraphs. They are now engaging with something that's giving them small kernels of ideas to work with and asking them to provide follow-up questions. And what was really fascinating was to watch students slowly migrate into this communication and dialogue with this AI tool that many times those students wouldn't have been feeling comfortable to do in a classroom environment where there's just a whole bunch of other social things that are happening in that space, or even having those conversations with an instructor where there's this kind of authoritarian thing going on as well, that now they've got this kind of very neutral partner in communication that they can use to kind of help them get a better understanding of the material.
Thank you. That was really helpful in kind of understanding what that looks like. In terms of students learning and teachers teaching, which of course has been going on for thousands of years, as we've talked about, tools have been introduced throughout the years as they evolve and come about or created. And AI being the newest one, what are some of the specific benefits? And you have touched on this a little bit already, but the benefits of implementing these AI-assisted tools in educational settings, and I think something folks are really curious about as well, are what are the accompanying risks that we should take into consideration or that we're already seeing?
For students, the big benefit is going to be in accessibility and personalization. So AI can make learning materials more adaptive. Whether that's in translating text into another language or generating captions or framing math problems in terms that connect to their personal interests. That kind of scaffolding can really make learning feel less abstract and more engaging. But for teachers, that benefit is really going to be seen in efficiency and insight. So AI can help draft course materials, summarize the student's work, highlight patterns that you're seeing in the engagement that might otherwise go unnoticed. And that can really free up time for more of the human side of teaching, the mentorship, the conversations, the creativity. The risks that kind of come with these is, first off, I think everyone's on board with this one, which is over-reliance, right? This idea that students are just going to copy your assignment prompt, put it into AI, have it spit out an essay, copy that essay, and spit it back in, and what actual learning is happening there. There was a faculty member that I worked with, and it really stuck in my mind, where he said that students believe that seeing enough answers constitutes learning. And so if they just look at enough solutions enough, that somehow that's what's going to stick, rather than the process of constructing answers themselves or struggling and getting through and kind of making those step-by-step progresses towards a better understanding of problems and answers. So over-reliance is a big risk on this. If the AI is always available to generate answers, then critical thinking can actually just be short-circuited instead of being strengthened. For teachers, there's the risk of both bias and burnout, right? Bias in the sense that AI tools may be reinforcing inequities if they aren't designed carefully. So for example, what is AI trained on? AI is trained on the entire internet. What does the entire internet consist of? Well, it consists of a majority voice by a majority group that holds power and privilege enough to be able to put that information out there. It was really fascinating to talk to some of these AI companies, and specifically AI companies that are in the writing space, and asking them what are their concerns about the homogenization of voice that comes along with AI-assisted writing. And they didn't understand what I was asking. They didn't understand what the problem might be in AI continually to spit out the same voice consistently over and over again, and how that might be marginalizing the voices of the actual users of the tools themselves. So that's one. Others are things like, you know, if anybody's ever played around with AI image generation, I encourage you try the prompt, give me a room full of parolees waiting for their parole officer. And you would be surprised. Well, I guess maybe you wouldn't be surprised at what the AI produces as a result of that prompt. So again, AI could be reinforcing these inequities, that if you're not carefully designing the prompts and carefully oversighting the outputs that the AI is producing. And then finally, burnout, which is that if the faculty feels like they have to constantly police new uses of this technology instead of using it constructively. And I think that's been a big part of the efforts I'm trying to work towards, was let's get away from this kind of AI plagiarism conversation, and let's start looking at what can we be doing to change our assessment methods and really leverage AI, if it's appropriate, to offload lower level thinking, make your outcomes be at a higher level of Bloom's taxonomy, and really start reinforcing things like critical thinking, evaluation, critique, and recognizing what's good and bad AI output. I could throw 30 AI generated essays at a student now and say, what are good about these and what are bad about these? Being able to do that pre-AI would have been insanely labor intensive for a faculty member to do.
And I've got a hard-hitting question for you. You had mentioned the benefit being efficiency and freeing up teachers to have more of that human time. But I think there's a lot of people worried about those efficiencies being, you know, taken advantage of to limit how much labor is being put in to maximize profits, whether in an academic setting or not. How do we as users, teachers, and students ensure that we are continuing to allow space for that human time as well as AI-assisted learning?
That's a really, really hard one to answer. And let me tell you why. The pace at which these tools are accelerating is beyond anything that we've seen regarding computer-based technologies historically. The release cycle on these things is so fast. As a result of that, it's not even clear what that type of exploitation would look like and how quickly that, say, let's say some, you know, someone with ill intent who's seeking to exploit workers would implement something that would be forcing workers to be implementing AI in this way that would be trying to gain more and more labor out of them, that 2 weeks later, something's not going to come around that's going to make it easier for those workers to just complete that task without additional labor, right? The idea is that, oh, the employer wants this XYZ. Well, the AI tool is going to develop itself at a point where XYZ can be effectively done with minimal increase to labor along the way. And so I think that the efficiency is going to be going through the roof, but rather than being on the backs of the laborers themselves, it's going to be on the backs of the machine itself. And that brings up a larger question, which is, what is the real cost of these AI tools outside of the human interaction? But these things take energy, these things take water. And while a lot of these problems are going to be solved, and I trust technology to solve the ecological problems that are associated with technology, in the interim, we've got a lot of questions to ask about that use.
The metaphoric image that I'm getting as you're talking is that we need to have creative human beings that are surfing in front of the wave being the advancement of AI and how fast that's coming. We can control ourselves as long as we're surfing in front of it, but once that wave crashes over us, we're doomed. I started getting that image when you talked about changing methods of evaluation as a result of AI as a solution to or mitigation to the cheating problem, which would open up human beings to do things that AI can't do at this point, higher level thinking. Now, that's not to say that we're going to be able to keep that pace, because it looks like general artificial intelligence will be with us sometime in our future. But we can get to that a little bit more when we talk about living with AI. I'd like to turn now to talking about using AI in educational settings, to using it for the general population, and especially thinking of our listeners in this respect, those who identify as lifelong learners and critical thinkers who might want to use AI as a tool to help them gain background knowledge and essential understanding of the issues, as we say in our definition of critical thinking, for finding and evaluating evidence relevant to forming claims, conclusions, and beliefs. So what are your thoughts about how AI could assist us, our users, lifelong learners, critical thinkers in critical thinking and decision-making, and specific, maybe currently available, preferably free AI tools that we could all use for that?
Yeah, I had the opportunity during the last election, presidential election cycle, to partake in a lecture series about the election. And I, along with my colleague, John Sullins, who, if you have a chance to research some of the work of John Sullins, he's been operating in this kind of AI robotic space for far predating, you know, the ChatGPT release. We spoke on misinformation and deep fakes in the election cycle. So there's some really interesting things that came out in the last election, and those things were what I would consider to be parody or to be more humorous than they would be considered misinformation. The AI voices, while they sound convincing, to hear AI voice of Gavin Newsom, you know, making these outrageous claims about himself and his policies, not technically going to be believable by the general population. So not what I would really consider as misinformation in that way. And what I got from that, because it was a lecture series that was more for a general audience, and a large number of the folks that were in that audience were of the wiser generation. And what I found was that they were very fascinating learning more about how these technologies could be integrated into some of the things that they are interested in doing. And so part of my lecture was showing how you could generate a script, how you could generate a video, how you could have that video be filled with stock images of, you know, whatever it was that was related to your script. Like I was doing content generation in relation to how deepfakes are created. And there seemed a lot of interest in that. So one of the things that I'm going to be doing next semester is teaching a class for that audience on memoir writing. And I think that's a really good entryway into getting to know and interact with AI. So I'm always telling folks, just use it. Use it daily for 2 weeks, and that will be enough for you to get a sense. And people are like, well, what do I do with it? Well, how about you start just talking to it about you and your experiences? And what you'll find is that it has been programmed to be very complimentary and to be very encouraging of you to continue to use it. Like all good technology is designed to do, it's thriving on greater engagement. And what I think folks will find by interacting with these tools, these kind of large language model chatbots, so your ChatGPT, your Google Gemini, is that you'll start to hear what the voice of AI is. And from that, you'll start to hear what the benefits are. And you'll also start to hear what some of the downsides are, where it falls short. And I think that's the best starting point. And I think that using it in a dialogue format where it's not just these one-shot prompts and getting an answer, but where you follow up and you ask further questions and you go deeper into the conversations, that you'll find that it gets better. And after some time, you might find that it goes astray and it goes like in a direction that was far away from where you wanted to go. And then you can just start over with a new chat and engage with it more. I think that's the best way to get started. I think from that, you might want to start looking at very specific use case tools. So, for example, Perplexity is a AI model that was designed more in the research space. And so it's kind of more of a web browser, web search type of a tool where you could search on a topic and it'll generate the sources, summaries of those sources, and links to those sources. So, which helped very early on with trying to reduce things like hallucinations that people were concerned about. Now, most of the models have access to web search. And as a result of that, a lot of the hallucination rate has declined. But it's all defined on the size of the context window. And once you get past the context window, hallucinations are going to be more prevalent. In terms of even reducing hallucination rates even further, I think NotebookLM is a great place to go. NotebookLM is a tool by Google. It's designed primarily on summarization of sources. So you can provide to Notebook LM PDFs, Word documents, just pasted text, MP3 files. It will analyze the audio and pull out the text of the audio and analyze that. YouTube videos, where it'll read the transcript of those YouTube videos. And so you can put all these sources into a notebook and it will give a summary of all of those sources in one kind of conglomerate. And then what's great about it is you can start asking questions of that, of those documents. You can say, what is the thing that I need to study the most on the p-value? And then suddenly it'll go to my study guide and it'll pull out all of the references to the p-value in that study guide, give quick little AI-generated summaries of those topics, and then direct citations to the source materials and where those things are mentioned. So I think that's a great tool for research and for learning more about particular topics, because this is a larger conversation as well, but I think long form reading and long form writing are on their way out. And that is a very, very difficult thing to both say and to really think through the ramifications of.
Describe that a little bit. What do you mean long form writing as opposed to what?
Well, I think here's a good example of this. When we as researchers learn about how to do literature reviews, we're taught very early on, you don't read that entire article. You skim the article, you go to the methods, you go to the results, and then you decide whether or not those results and those methods are applicable to your research, and you either put them in one pile of good or you put them in another pile of bad and you move on to the next. And so there's not this kind of expectation that folks are reading the entirety of that research article in the process of understanding what that research is and understanding whether or not that research is applicable to be utilized further for their own. And next thing you learn to do, go look at their sources to see if there's other sources that you want to find from that, and then repeat that process on new sources. Well, we're in a whole new landscape where the machine can do all of that for us. And the machine can generate a summary of whether or not that article is appropriate for your research, and it can actually help you with that process. So now I'm reading that AI summary, and I have two things that I have to do. One, I have to read through and determine whether or not the AI got it right. And that means I have to be both willing to go back to those source materials and dig into those source materials with enough rigor to know whether or not this AI is correct in its interpretation of this. And then two, to know whether or not I'm providing the AI with enough of the context of what it is that I'm actually after so that it is making informed decisions about whether or not it's applicable to the work. So, well, what does that bring us to? Well, it brings us to the actual documentation itself. Was that document written for an AI to be doing that? Most likely, no. We're not writing documentation for machines. We're writing documentation for humans. We're writing in sentence structures and paragraph structures and narratives and stories in ways that we hope human readers will appreciate and enjoy. And that is what I think is going to change. In early of my AI research, I stumbled on some document structure for presenting to workshops. And that document was filled with header structure, was filled with subsections and substructures that were designed for particular tasks. So if in the presentation of a concept, you're wanting to break that concept into discussion amongst participants, here's a section of reading for that. If you're wanting to provide suggested language and changes and improvements of a process, here's a subsection of the workshop that's designed for that. I'm kind of thinking through and coining this idea about machine actionable documentation, the idea that we're going to be designing our documents with header structures, subsections, breaking things down in a format that machines and humans are going to be able to ingest in a way to take better action based on those documents.
The ability to summarize. Well, one thing I'm thinking of, that's going to save me a lot of highlighters, because the summaries will just be obvious. The machine is doing what I would do with my highlighter, right?
Highlighting. I absolutely encourage you not to use a highlighter on your computer screen.
All right. I have to change my habits, I guess. That's Notebook LM that you were describing that does that kind of summarizing, correct?
That's great. Yep.
You've mentioned two, Perplexity and Notebook LM. Now, are those free? Are they available on a free basis or are they subscriptions?
Perplexity is free. It's essentially like a browser search function. They do have a paid model that I know some faculty members have chosen to adopt for, I would say, greater research purposes. But the best way I could describe what Perplexity does is similar to what I'm sure most of you have seen when you've done Google searches now, which is this kind of AI summary that appears. And so I think the key difference, though, is that AI summary doesn't always provide the direct link to the sources where that generation was coming from, where Perplexity is kind of designed around the idea of you're interested in topic X. Here is the summary of that topic. Here are some ideas related to that topic. And here are summaries of the sources that I'm providing you links out to. Mm-hmm. So it's giving you enough of that understanding of what the source is before you actually have to click on that link and do that research yourself.
Yeah, I noticed Copilot is doing more of that than it seemed to be doing when I was first using it. Now, Notebook LM, is that free or a subscription?
That is a free tool that's through Google. So if you've got a Gmail account, you have access to Notebook LM.
Great.
There's some functionality that is limited in scope. So for example, it has a lot of bells and whistles. So one of the bells and whistles is things like being able to generate a mind map, which is just essentially a visual breakdown of the concepts that kind of has nested breakdowns all the way through. It can do document briefing. So like something that you would be taking into like a meeting based on that document, or even something like a study guide that'll even provide like simple quiz questions and essay questions and a glossary, a lot of things like that, which are great for studying, great for learning. And then some of the kind of more gimmicky things, such as an AI podcast. So a couple years back, you guys talked about AI. I took the MP3 of that, dumped it into Notebook LM, and had the AI podcasters talk about your podcast on AI. So very, very meta. The most recent one that they released is a video overview where it will generate something that's kind of more reminiscent of like a slide deck kind of presentation on the content. And so it'll break it down into like four or five concepts and then kind of walk through with some key examples and some threaded narrative on the concept. So quick example of that, I uploaded a one-page study guide, all of the concepts that I want my students to study for preparation on a final exam in an elementary statistics course. This video overview chose on its own that the narrative it was going to use was criminal investigation. So gathering evidence, stating hypothesis, you know, using that evidence to come to conclusions. And it just framed all around guilt and innocence, which gets you back to type one, type two errors. And it came up with that as the narrative on its own. All the document was a bunch of bulleted points of topics of discussion that were related to an elementary statistics course.
Okay, so we've just seen an application for the legal system, AI-assisted legal research.
Oh, I work with this professor in criminal justice, and she is amazing. Shout out to Caitlin Henry. She is great. She had her students follow this pretty high-profile hip-hop lyrics case where a rapper is being accused of RICO charges and related to lyrics in his songs. And you can imagine in a high-profile case the number of documents that are related to that case that are being released to the public record, right? And so she's using Notebook LM with her students to have them develop their own notebooks where you're limited to the number of sources you can include in any one notebook. So she's having her students learn how to, what makes a good source to add, what's not so good a source to add, right? So if there's just a briefing that's extending a deadline of discovery, or if it's a briefing that's just changing a lawyer or to change a date of a case, those are probably not good things to include in your limited number of sources. But if there's, you know, witnesses or there's actual testimony, those are things that you probably want to include. Or if there's, you know, in this case, there was a lot of like controversy around the actual judge. Those are all things that are valuable to include. And then the students are generating their own podcasts based on those briefings that they've selected, and then sharing those podcasts with each other, and then critiquing whether or not the analyses of those podcasters on those briefings are valuable. So yeah, the legal profession is blown up as a result of tools like NotebookLM and just AI in general.
Before we move on, I want to mention that one of the things we like to do on Thinking Clearly is to provide resources. So when we put some links on to this show, we will link to Perplexity and Notebook. I'll try those and see how they work, and we'll link to those. Are there any other programs, applications that you might think of that would be helpful to our audience?
It would be a crime for me not to mention ChatGPT. ChatGPT is a very, very useful chatbot that is kind of leading the way when it comes to a lot of functionality and a lot of what's being provided, even at the free level. Now, I will be honest and say that I have, as a result of the California State University's partnership with OpenAI, that I have had an enterprise level account with them. So functionality of things like agent mode, where I'm having this thing navigating the website on its own and extracting information from websites on its own and putting them into tables. Those are things that I don't think are going to be in that free space. But nonetheless, ChatGPT is probably one of the best chatbots that you can be looking at. There's other ones that I think are worth examining, which are like Google Gemini also has a free version that you could be interacting with. And if you are a kind of Google person, then having that tool and having that tool interact with some of the other platforms that Google provides is probably not a bad place to get started. And then the other one is Claude, I think. And Claude seems to be a favorite for those that are interested in things like coding. And so that's another model that I would suggest people looking at. On the educator side of things, I think every educator in the K-12 system should be looking at KhanMigo as a kind of first step, because it does a lot of things like aligning with standards that I think are useful. So that tool has been designed around the K-12 standards. And then there's another one called Magic School. And that one's also in that educator space, K-12 primarily focused. That just has a lot of like what I would consider like entry level ideas about what you might use this tool for. So things like generating a introduction to a lesson that kind of captures the attention. They've got like a pre-built little model for that, or writing a letter of recommendation. It's got a pre-little built model for that. Things that are kind of related to the instructional role. It's got a bunch of little small little pre-built tasks that are designed for those purposes.
And if I could just chime in, I don't have a specific suggestion, but I don't think it can be overstated enough, the accessibility tools, whether someone's hard of hearing, visually impaired, speech impaired, there's just amazing high quality accessibility AI tools out there on the internet as well, which Kyle, as you mentioned earlier, really creates a lot more equity in learning and how we use these tools.
Yeah, our DSS department is using a tool called Jamworks, which is very, very similar to what NotebookLM does, but also has the added benefit of being able to record lectures, be able to provide transcripts, and then directly integrate those things in to be able to do things like summarize that transcript and be able to ask interesting questions of that transcript or of the summarization of the lecture. So yeah, definitely a lot of accessibility tools. And a lot of these tools are really designed around accessibility as well.
So again, we've touched on these things, but I think, you know, really kind of to focus in on it, Kyle, what are your hopes, dreams, and fears about our shared future with AI? And what needs to be done to mitigate the possible negative impacts of AI in the future? Of course, understanding that it's very fast moving and evolving quicker than we can predict.
I've been really thinking about this regularly in trying to help educators better understand what the role of AI might be in the classroom. I'm regularly thinking about what's going to be happening next. And I do get a little bit of a head start because I'm operating this kind of educational technology space. So I'm getting to see like some demos of what's on the future pipeline. And a lot of those things, because they are so just like snippets of what's coming, there's a lot of like inspiring thought that comes out of that. But what it really all boils back down to me, and this is just like in terms of our shared future with AI, it's really captured in probably the best scene of the film Waking Life. There's this kind of dialogue that's happening between the main character and somebody who's talking about the idea of our kind of telescoping evolution, how each phase of human development from life itself to agriculture to the Industrial Revolution is happening on this shorter and shorter time scale. And so this suggestion that we may now be living through this kind of new evolutionary leap, one that's driven now by information, digital on the AI side, analog on the biological side, and this kind of interwoven into this like neurobiology. So what really excites me about this vision is the possibility of this, like, it's described again in Waking Life as this neo-human evolution. So it's not cold, competitive, not like one that's focused on war and about capitalism and about profits, but really one that's like amplifying truth and justice and freedom. That's like AI could really help accelerate us towards this world where human potential isn't limited by time and space, where technology enhances our capacity for empathy, creativity, rather than eroding it. Alongside that hope, that idealistic idea of this kind of like symbiosis of human and technology is fear, right? The very telescoping itself could lead to incredible breakthroughs, but risks moving so fast that our social structures, our ethics, or even our individual ability to adapt can't keep up. So the fear here is that instead of just amplifying our best traits, that AI could just easily magnify our worst, right? More inequality, more exploitation, more misinformation. And so the question really becomes is like, what do we have to do? So for me, it goes back to like critical stewardship. So building systems that emphasize transparency and equity and human oversight. So creating spaces in education, not just to use AI, but to question it, to test it, to debate its implications. And that just means holding on to like the core critical thinking pieces of intellectual humility, right? Being willing to say, I don't know yet, but I'm willing to learn.
Yeah, it seems like the spectrum of opinions on what our AI future is going to be is pretty polarized. Some people are at one end and saying that it's going to force us to become bored hedonists with no sense of purpose. And on the other side, people are expressing the opinion that it's going to make us human slaves to super intelligent silicon masters. So I'm really appreciating that you are taking the approach that what can we do to actually energize more of our human potential rather than either one of those ends of that spectrum?
I work with a community of folks that meet almost daily through various social media platforms. And that community is AI Learning Labs. And so you can find them on TikTok, you can find them on YouTube. And Kyle, who runs that community, he regularly describes this idea that like work is gonna radically change no matter what, for good or for bad. The concept of work and labor as we know it is radically going to be changing, and it's going to create new spaces of jobs that are entirely revolving around human creativity. He states something like LED macrame is going to be a job in the future, right? And so, you know, get excited about learning how to do human creativity things that are involving technology, because that is the future that we have before us.
What's your opinion on whether AI needs to be regulated and what degree?
Yeah, I thought a decent amount about this early on when there was some push to do some very, very quick regulation. And the idea I have there is just that I don't want a bunch of politicians who have never touched ChatGPT to be regulating ChatGPT. I think it's really important that all of us use AI, get to know what AI is, and have enough of a familiarity and a baseline understanding of what it can do and what the harms are, the potential harms are, and the potential benefits are before we make any sort of decision about regulation. By all means, there is definitely going to be regulation on AI in the future. But if it took us, what, 25 years to even tax the internet, I think regulating AI this early on in its development comes with it more risk than it does benefit.
What would the risks be to regulating it?
You know, part of that kind of paired future of either being able to advance human creativity and evolution and growth can be throttled through regulation. And instead, if we restrict AI and then put it to a point where really those with money and power are the only ones that are able to innovate and create and really drive the direction of AI, then we just end up right back where we are with like the degradation of the internet as a result of social media and as a result of very rich and powerful companies shaping the direction of the tools that we use. And I don't want to see that with AI. I want to be able to see us be able to, hey, here's how a large language model basically works. Here's a base framework for a large language model that's already been developed. Let's put it in the hands of students and let's see what they're able to create. If we start regulating the creation of large language models, if we start regulating the ability for people to adapt large language models for custom purpose, we're threatening ourselves into a space where we get even more homogenization through the limited access large language models.
Any last minute thoughts that you have, Kyle, for our audience?
The last thing I just really would want to say is to just play with the tools. There's a lot of fun that you could be having in that space. And in the process of trying to have fun with these tools, you're going to learn a lot. You're going to learn about how they work. You're going to learn about a lot about how they don't work. And I expect that you'll be inspired in some way with what you could be doing. A lot of the things that I'm finding usefulness in is things like social justice work, being able to support groups of people that have not historically had access to academic voices, have not historically had access to being able to use voice in a powerful way in a public setting, being able to provide a community of folks in like say a low income housing cooperative that are getting mass evicted to provide public comment to policymakers that they wouldn't have been able to generate that on their own without a lot of help and support. Now they've got a tool that they can just put in what their issues are, tell them what the situation is, ask for legal precedent, ask for key examples, and actually generate really empowering things. And I think that all of us have a responsibility of trying to find ways that we can do that and use the tools that are available to us to do those things.
Be curious, play with it.
And Kyle, thank you so much for that final summary. You did it without AI, I see. I want to thank you for sharing your experience and your thoughts about using AI in education and for helping us think about how lifelong learners and critical thinkers like our audience might benefit from available AI tools. So on our Facebook page, we will link to your faculty pages at Sonoma State University, to the Center for Teaching and Educational Technology website, and to those applications that we talked about a few minutes ago. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post, Kyle?
I think there is a YouTube channel for the Center for Teaching and Educational Technology, and that's got a lot of AI content on there.
Okay. And to our listeners, I want to thank you very much for your support. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly. Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.